Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Molasses Manifesto.
When did you first take command of Son of Sam?
Well, it just came to me, you know, because I've always had a wild imagination. And the idea of calling myself Son of Sam, I guess, just came to me. Maybe I read Son of Something in a book, but I'm not really cognizant of it. I don't really recall, you know. I just named it after Sam Carr, because Sam Carr was causing me a lot of aggravation with his dog barking. Now, let me take the dog wasn't talking, as I said, it was barking.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog to carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story. It's not for anybody else, it's for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 14, Becoming Son of Sam. Act 1, a very public announcement. After David Berkowitz viciously gunned down 19-year-old Virginia Voskarichian while she was walking through her own upper-middle-class neighborhood, Forest Hill, Queens, at 7:30 in the evening, residents, whipped up into a near-mob-like frenzy, took matters and guns into their own hands. This had been the second violent attack in their community in a little over 2 months. New York City Mayor Abraham Beam, fearing the situation was starting to get out of control, had this to say. Quote, "We had fears that the situation was escalating. I never liked vigilante groups of any sort, no matter their intention. The police are trained to do their jobs. Civilians aren't." End quote. People were understandably upset and acting in ways, although perhaps misguided, that they thought would help protect their loved ones. And of course, the press weren't helping, releasing the following headline, the very same evening as the Voskarichian murder: Coed's killer may strike again. A few days later, the address for Virginia's funeral service at the Maple Grove Cemetery in Flushing, Queens was also published, releasing the information to the general public, as well as also to, perhaps, the killer himself. It was official. Things were definitely getting out of hand. So much so that the mayor was forced to assign a security detail to the service in order to at least attempt to give the family some privacy and avoid any potential scene that could possibly prove to escalate matters further. They just couldn't take that chance. It was now clear to everyone, especially the powers that be, that police were going to have to act swiftly if they had any hope of bringing this senseless string of violent murders to a close before it had any further devastating effects on the city. And so it was that on March 10th, 1977, just 2 days after the murder of Virginia Voskarichian, New York City Police Commissioner Michael Codd announced that a warrant had been issued for an as-of-yet unnamed white male between the ages of 25 and 30 years old, giving this almost cinematic cliche-level description of a flasher-type bad guy as the suspect.
"The general description that we have is of a male, white, 25 to 30 years of age, 5 feet 10 inches to 6 feet in height, medium build, well-groomed, with dark hair which is combed straight back, and wearing a raincoat type of outer garment, tan or brownish."
The announcement, meant to encourage public aid in the investigation, was the direct result of a ballistics match that linked Deloria, Freund, and Voskarichian murders together, identifying them as the work of one lone gunman.
We have determined that there has been a .44 caliber revolver used in every one of them, which is why, as the mayor mentioned, it's important that any person having information with respect to anyone who's in possession of a .44 caliber revolver call us.
However, detectives were not solely relying on the public to help them stop the gunmen. They had also increased their own efforts as well, although slowly at first. Quote, "We have increased our patrols in those areas we feel have been targets of this killer, and hope the public will cooperate with the police in their efforts to apprehend this individual," end quote. 1 month later, on April 19, 1977, as things continued to escalate, Codd took it a step further, announcing that a special task force, officially named the Omega Task Force, had been created to stop the killer. Deputy Inspector Timothy J. Dowd was assigned to oversee the operation. His second in command was Police Chief Joseph Borelli of the 15th Homicide Division. It was later said the Deputy Commissioner for Public Information, Francis J. McLaughlin, told Borelli, quote, "Joe, this one's going to be the biggest case in the history of the department," end quote. Before it was all over, that is exactly what it would be. But at this specific moment, it was still only winding up, and the announcement, no doubt intended to convince the general citizenry that those in charge were taking the situation seriously, had other unintended effects. And that was that the average everyday citizen for whom the announcement was intended weren't the only ones that heard it. David heard it too, or rather he read it in the paper. Quote, "I read about this group they had started to get me. It was in the papers and on television. I remembered Borelli and Dowd. I followed them from that day on. Whenever anything was written about me, I read it. I also listened to the radio when it came up. I knew that they'd get me someday. The only question was how and when," end quote. David Berkowitz had become, as really he always had been, his own biggest fan, clipping out newspaper articles and saving them, amassing a pile of visual aids he could use to relive the murders and relish in his quote-unquote accomplishments again and again. But it wasn't just hero worship David was actively involved in. He was also very much aware that in addition to being his own biggest fan, that he was himself the central villain in this rather macabre melodrama, and therefore a direct participant, able to pull the strings at will, upping the stakes and controlling the contents of what eventually he would clip out and paste into his own growing scrapbook.
After Berkowitz realized that he had got the attention of not just the police but the media in New York City, he began to really feed on that. He began to develop an identity that he began to aggrandize and fictionalize within himself, partly by way of giving himself some sort of identity and perhaps for the first time a reason for these otherwise inexplicable murders he was committing, but mainly to exploit the publicity and crank it up to the highest level possible.
And so it was, with this in mind, that on April 1st, 1977, David Berkowitz began composing a 4-page letter to Detective Borelli. But starting up a correspondence with his new adversary wasn't the only thing he was up to. As David prepared to taunt police directly, he was also busy fighting with his neighbors. Act 2. Molotov Cocktails for Two. On May 16th, 1977, at 5 o'clock in the morning, David Berkowitz combined red wine with Red Devil varnish remover and poured it in a bottle before stuffing it with a ripped undershirt and heading out the door. Avoiding the street lamps on the pre-dawn streets, he made his way to 18 Wicker Street, where his neighbors, Robert and Mara Netto, lived with their dog. David lit the match, threw the cocktail, and ran. This would be the first Molotov cocktail he would throw at neighbors that irritated him, but it would not be the last.
In addition to having upped the game to serial murder at this point, he was continuing with his old fallback as an arsonist, starting fires as a form of anonymous revenge against people who were in some way simply annoying him.
The very next month, in April of 1977, he threw another Molotov cocktail at his neighbor Sam Carr's house and, missing it by a mile, landed in the paved backyard, igniting in a plume of black smoke.
I came across some reference to some alleged firebombing of somebody's house. Did you ever firebomb somebody's house?
Yeah, I did.
When did that happen?
Around April of 77. I threw a Molotov cocktail against the door of Sam Carr's house.
This is Carr's house.
Okay. I admit it was pretty extreme, but it was that dog, his dog, inconsiderate.
David says he threw the cocktail because he found Sam Carr's dog, Harvey, to be inconsiderate. I mean, who wouldn't be enraged by an inconsiderate dog? Jack asks David if he ever firebombed anyone else's house, and he immediately fesses up to firebombing the Nettos.
Did you firebomb anybody else's house?
Yeah. The house on Wicker Street, there was another one. Yeah, that was the one also had a dog. You know, they both were...
Any other firebombings?
I think that was it.
Jack asks David if the Carrs or the Nettos knew who was behind the bombings.
Did Carr or these other people know that you were the one doing the firebombing?
From what I understand, after a while they got an idea it was. But they didn't know. I never met them personally.
What gave them the idea?
Well, it was a whole series of circumstances. It's pretty complex.
On April 10th, 1977, a few days before he threw the firebomb at Sam Carr's house, David put down the letter he was pinning to Detective Borelli and fired off a quick one to Sam Carr complaining about Harvey. Quote, "Our lives have been torn apart by this dog," end quote. It was signed, a citizen.
We're dealing with somebody who was unable to confront the source of their annoyance or grievances, and being kept up all night by barking dogs and loud television are a reason to confront someone in person. He couldn't do that, so he resorted to threatening letters.
And it wasn't just Sam Carr he was writing letters to.
One of the reasons that he couldn't sleep, in addition to the turmoil in his own mind and dogs that barked at neighbors' houses around him, was that he had moved in directly above a guy who liked to watch television late into the night and, according to David, played it very loud. David had written him a couple of anonymous, semi-threatening notes without signing them.
You know, the noise of the barking dogs, okay, you know, I can imagine what you went through there. Were there any other sort of grating, constant noises or anything that would drive you up the wall?
Yeah, the guy's TV set downstairs and the stereo next door.
Again, David, unable to approach the man with the loud TV, wrote letters and lit fires, saying later, quote, "This man had his TV on too loud. He drove me crazy. I was afraid to approach him," end quote. That man's name was Craig Glassman, and he was an auxiliary deputy sheriff in the Emergency Services Unit of the Westchester County Sheriff's Office in White Plains, where he volunteered in traffic control, patrolling schools, and providing security during community events. He wore a green uniform issued to him by the county sheriff, and he was licensed to carry a firearm. He was also recently divorced, which is why he had moved into the unit directly below Berkowitz, apartment 6E.
The cop that lived downstairs from you, I think he said downstairs.
Yes. He used to play his TV a lot. I looked in the phone book and I saw that his name was Craig Glassman. That's how it started.
Yep, you got that right. At the same time David Berkowitz was terrorizing New York City by stalking and murdering its young, he was also actively terrorizing the man who lived directly beneath him, who was, as it turned out, a cop of sorts. Jack asked David if he ever called Glassman to ask him to turn down his TV.
You ever called him up and said, "Turn down your goddamn television?"
Yes, yes, sure. And he never did, really, you know. He would turn it down that day, but the next day it would be loud again.
Before you got angry with him, did you say, "Hello, I'm sorry, my name is David Berkowitz, I live upstairs"?
No, I never revealed my name.
You didn't just say, "I live upstairs, and would you please turn down your television?"
I didn't tell him where I lived. I said, "I just live near you, and turn down the thing, you know, said, please turn down the set. And that was it, you know, it was unbelievable. No, you'd never think a human being could listen to a TV that loud. It was, I could hear everything, even the commercials, at 2 o'clock in the morning. I come home from the post office and be home about a little after 1 in the morning. And I'd come home, the TV would be blasting loud. I could not believe it, that these people, with him underneath me, and the person next to me playing the blasting stereo in the daytime, him playing the TV early in the morning, and the dog barking down in the, below my window, down the hill, all day long, it was unbelievable. It was just too much for me.
So just to recap, David Berkowitz had below him an overly loud TV set, next to him a blasting stereo, and out his window to the left at 18 Wicker Street, the Nettos with their dog, and directly below his window, Sam Carr and his dog. David Berkowitz was surrounded.
You must not have got any sleep at all living in a place like that.
Very little.
When you say very little, how much?
Well, sometimes 3 or 4 hours. That's usually it. Because I was up by sunrise because dogs came out, Sam Carr's dog, you know.
David also had, on the opposite side of his unit from the blasting stereo, an elderly neighbor in her 80s who also preferred a loud volume for her television. And so, being the nice, wholesome boy next door, David decided to write her a letter. It read as follows, quote, "What is the matter with you? Are you deaf or something? Why do you play your TV so loud? It is disgusting me. I hope you die," end quote. The poor old woman was frightened. However, her daughter was not. She tried to get her husband to call the police, but when he refused, she decided to confront David herself. The next time she saw him in the building, she cornered him and said, quote,
"Did you write these letters?"
To which Berkowitz just stood there frozen, grinning like a goon, not saying anything. She continued, quote,
"A nice boy like you shouldn't write such threatening letters. If someone bothers you, tell them."
Still, he said nothing, completely immobilized by the confrontation. The woman's mother, however, never received another letter. Jack asked David if tormenting his neighbors was his way of begging to be caught.
When you went over and shot his dog and, you know, started writing threatening letters and things like that, did you do that hoping that somebody would, that he would go to the cops and that these two would do together and you'd be caught?
Man, I suppose there was a hidden motivation back then.
Valid question, since throughout David Berkowitz's antagonism of his neighbors, he had continued to kill and seemed, quite unfortunately, to be getting better at it. With each murder, he was more brazen and less nervous, as each day he began to develop a story in his head, a story he could one day blame for all of his actions.
Well, I was, I guess, being a better shot, you know, but that's a sick thing to really think about, you know, because you're dealing with human beings that were being killed, you know, not just targets.
Did you aim to kill him?
Yes. I wanted to hurt them, but then I didn't want to hurt them. And I did and didn't, and I just psyched myself up to finally do it. After a while, you would think it got more easy to do it, but it got harder.
How did it get harder?
The reality of what I was doing began to crumble. I mean, well, the reality of what I was doing began to sink in. And any inadequate or nonsensical story I tried to make up to myself to convince myself that I was doing something that wasn't that bad or whatever, it just wasn't working.
David was deep down starting to feel the pangs of guilt. Guilt he was still feeling when Jack and Berkowitz sat down to record the interview around which this podcast is based inside the walls of Attica Prison in March of 1980.
Being here helps expiate some of that guilt.
Yeah. Because see, we live on it in a system of crime and punishment in this world. We might get away with something, you see, but if our consciences would get the best of us in a sense. There have been many like cases of criminals saying, I'm sure that if there's some way to check all this, that a lot of guys that would have put themselves in or committed crimes where they could have gotten away scot-free, but in the end wind up doing something absolutely stupid to give themselves up, you understand?
Pilmore did that.
Well, if not, just walk into the police station themselves and start confessing, you know? You haven't noticed this? There's so many times this happened. People really don't even notice this. A guy commits a crime. Let's say he holds up a store and kills two people or something. And 3 weeks go by. The police haven't solved the case yet. They don't know who did it. They only have a shady description. And this guy is not even a suspect. But you haven't noticed the case numerous times where they start confessing to people, dropping little hints. Like, I know something about that crime. They'll tell their friends or they'll confess to their girlfriends. So many guys have confessed to their girlfriends or their parents or something. This is a clear indication that they know they're guilty and they do want to get caught, you see. Because any man in his right mind, well, no, I'd say any man that is really cold-blooded would not start dropping these hints that he's committed a certain crime. And the next thing you know, his girlfriend or something goes to the police. And within a few weeks, he's arrested. Here was a case the police never would have solved, but of course they always say, well, he just got to bragging. Maybe some guys do sort of like brag or something, but there's more to it than that. You know, they're not that stupid. If they were smart enough to pull the crime expertly and get away with it without people getting more than a shady description of somebody, you see. The fact that they're in a ballroom or something bragging, or if they get drunk and they start confessing, you've heard about cases. This is not carelessness on their part, even though it may seem that way. And their subconscious mind, I think, talking through them. And they know that they're guilty, and inside them it's killing them. And so they start laying down this groundwork that's going to lead to their arrest, dropping off hints here and there, and other stupid things, you see.
He's trying to tell us that he has a conscience, but a very undeveloped conscience, other than what he conceived intellectually to be the conscience that you should have if you're a human being. Berkowitz was, at that time, trying to grow a conscience which, as a sociopath, he was incapable of developing.
It sounds strange, you know, but you have to understand the so-called neurotic criminal versus the normal criminal. You know what I mean? The normal criminal is a guy that has no real feelings, no emotional attachments or compunctions. They can just, like, you know, live a whole life of crime and never feel anything. You know what I mean? Just like a job, you know? Everything's black. The fact that they're illegal, you know, they're doing something illegal, doesn't matter. Their whole life is geared after, you know, committing crimes and eluding the police. And in my case, the ultimate goal of the crime was to get caught and punished, you know. The criminal, you know, the type of criminal that always manages to get captured or eventually walks into the police station, gives himself up and gives a whole confession, even before they were ever suspected. You know, you understand what I'm saying, right? That type of guy is different than the so-called normal criminal who would always commit a crime with the hopes of getting away and doing that again and again, you know.
Use it for some sexual thrill or some financial gain.
Yeah. Although the anger turned outward, you can't be fooled by it. True, I hurt innocent people, you see. But the ultimate harm was going to come to myself, too. Because it was inevitable that the capture was going to come sooner or later.
David Berkowitz was, according to him, starting to crack. Although the police were no closer to catching him than they had been at the beginning. And so he felt he was going to have to start doing things to egg them on. Act 3. If I'm not going to get caught, I'm going to need a story. Somewhere between the attack on Donna DeMasi and Joanne Lomino, November 27, 1976, and the attack on Christine Freund and John Deal on January 30, 1977, David Berkowitz had decided that if he was not going to be caught as quickly as he had originally thought, he was going to need a story. And not only that, but with a special task force designed to catch him, every press man from here to Timbuktu, printing every lead, and the entire city up in arms, he was not only going to need a story, but he was going to need one befitting all the attention he was now receiving. And he needed it for personal reasons as well. His eventual arrest would, in some ways, be his crowning achievement, completing the cycle of crime and punishment he had established in early childhood, his most glorious and monumental punishment to date, punishment to end all punishments. He was going to need something good, something spectacular, something no one had ever seen or heard before.
When did you first take the man to Son of Sam?
Well, it just came to me, you know, because I've always had a wild imagination. And the idea of calling myself Son of Sam, I guess, just came to me. Maybe I read Son of Something in a book, but I'm not really cognizant of it. I don't really recall, you know. I just named it after Sam Carr, because Sam Carr was causing me a lot of aggravation with his dog barking. Now, let me take the dog wasn't talking, as I said, it was barking.
So this was more an elaborate metaphor.
Yes, that's what it is. It was very elaborate, but it was nothing. You know?
David Berkowitz at this time started to develop in his mind the story that would eventually become the Son of Sam mythology, involving a 6,000-year-old Satan-type character named Sam, as well as a demon-infested dog who ordered him to kill through its incessant barking, amongst other things.
If he had been a writer, you know, could have made for some pretty good Stephen King vein fiction. This whole idea of animals who speak and demons who live in a hole in a wall and speak through the animals, ordering psychotic demon-possessed individual who was, you know, ordinary nice guy by day, change into my evil cape at night and become Son of Sam.
It was, I have to say, pretty original. Jack asked David when he started toying around with the Son of Sam identity.
And what about the demon thing? When did that?
That started around the third or fourth crime, maybe around November or December of 1976.
Did it happen? Happened about the same time that the identity of the Son of Sam came about then?
What? What's his name?
The demon.
Yeah, well, that's where I got it from. See, that suddenly I started to blame Sam Carr for everything. And in order for me to get the blame on him, I had to try to convince myself somehow that he was at fault and that his dog was giving me orders and things.
Here's a letter David Berkowitz wrote to Sam Carr dated April 19th, 1977. I have asked you to kindly stop that dog from howling all day long, yet he continues to do so. I pleaded with you. I told you how this is destroying my family. We have no peace, no rest. Now I know what kind of person you are and what kind of family you are. You are cruel and inconsiderate. You have no love for any other human beings. You are selfish, Mr. Carr. My life is destroyed now. I have nothing to lose anymore. I can see that there shall be no peace in my life or my family's life until I end yours. I think it's safe to say that no one has ever been more bothered by a dog than David Berkowitz.
He had come to despise the neighbor with the barking dogs, whose name he knew was Samuel Carr. And I think going back to his time with the evangelicals during his military service in Kentucky, he learned how to blame the devil for evils that otherwise most of us don't understand, our own moral failings, whether it's infidelities or petty thefts or whatever. We're not really that person. Some powerful, sinister force made us do that. That sells. It strikes some sort of a primal chord instilled since childhood by most of us who are raised in any of the major religions, that there is an evil force out there that we have to battle against. And he gave it a face. He gave it an identity.
All right, let me try to explain this. Here I was committing crimes of violence against innocent people. I didn't at that time understand any motives for what I was doing. And of course, this was bothering me because why am I doing this? I mean, I've asked that, riding around in my car with a gun by my side, I've been asking myself this question a multitude of times, thousands and thousands of times. Why? Whatever, I needed some type of justification. And I had to convince myself that, no, I'm not the man that's doing this. It's some sinister force that's controlling me. Sam Carr, Satan and his henchmen, these are the evil ones. I'm not the guilty one. You know, I'm just trying to convince myself that I'm not guilty.
David Berkowitz was playing the blame game.
That's a psychological yo-yo that I think we all have to learn how to spin on a string from, you know, because we all feel anger, and when we act on that anger, we all feel guilt. These are perfectly natural things. Berkowitz felt both in the extreme, and as a person who nurtured more than anything else his own solitude and his own sore spot and his own self-pity, they were both exaggerated in his mind. The anger to justify the murders and the guilt to make me feel like I'm really not that person. I'm really not a bad guy. I feel guilt. I feel bad for the families. I felt bad for my mom when she could do nothing but lie in bed and cry for days after my grandfather died. It's a yo-yo that he never learned to put away.
It was hard for me to accept that I was actually committing cold-blooded murder, because I didn't understand why I was doing it. I had no conception of why I was doing it. And I needed something to hang on to in order for me to just cover over any guilt feelings that were gnawing away inside me. But I was not successful at that. And in the end, I realized that I was trapped.
As far as David saw it, he was trapped, and the Son of Sam mythology was his only way out, although it was, of course, only a deeper way in, as he would eventually come to see.
So this was all after the fact?
Yeah.
The whole demon thing was...
Right. It wasn't until after the third or fourth shooting that I began to use the demon thing. As I told you before, it was like the first two or three shootings, maybe, if I would have been caught, why are you doing this? I don't know. And that's all I could have said. But after a while, I guess as I began to commit more and more crimes, the guilt, even though I was unconscious of it at the time, was beginning to set in more and more, which would make sense. And now the need for a story, you know, a reason, if not for anybody else and for myself.
When you become so angry, like the way all the angers have built up into me, it built up inside me, you lose your perception of guilt. Because you see... To put it frankly, you become so angry that you don't give a shit. That's what you mentioned before about the death penalty the last time you hear whether that would have affected me. No, because I have no... You see, at this time, I had no self-worth. And I had no value of my own life, much less anybody else's. So something like the death penalty, it doesn't affect me, you see. But once you become so angry, you lose a sense of guilt. Because you feel justified. Of course, after a time, like in my case, the guilt seeped in. Even though I deliberately repressed it, it was only a matter of time before it was going to burst through the surface, you see, to a point where I had to get it off my chest. But there, as long as you're going to be so angry about something, then you're going to lose your sense of guilt for what you're doing.
Jack asked David if he ever succumbed to his guilt and dropped a hint before his arrest.
Did you ever start dropping hints?
Sure.
How soon after you started on the spree?
Not long, because the letters started.
You mean the letters you sent to Breslin?
Yeah.
He probably wasn't getting as much of a thrill out of it as he was initially after proving that he could do it. It had to take a lot of psychic energy to do what he was doing. And in some ways, I think he did want to be caught. I don't think it was because of his conscience. I think he was just getting tired of it. This is too easy. Now that I can do it and hit a target every time, I need a new game.
David seemed to agree, saying, quote, "Towards the end of my spree, I developed a keen perception of police tactics. I began to figure out just where and when a cop car would pass or where a stakeout car would be parked. I really got good at this. Expert. After a while, I was able to spot an unmarked car regardless of its disguise. Some were taxi cabs. Some were beat up old rattle traps. But they were police cars just the same, and I made them. Unmarked police vans were also a frequent sight. I had developed a mental warning and caution device in my mind, and it worked. End quote. David Berkowitz was unstoppable. Or so he thought. Next time on Killer Tape. David finishes his letter to Detective Borelli, leaving it at the scene of his most violent attack to date.
That was in the Bronx. Two people were killed in that. That was my worst as far as the number of victims. I had killed two people at the time. A girl and a guy in a car. They were parked in his lover's lane and they were making out. I snuck up on them and shot them.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt and Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.